If you see how he deals with Trump, my God, he can twist Trump around his finger.
Well, indeed, we are likely to hear from the Kremlin when and if Jacob Zuma does actually resign. And of course, like, we do know that Russia and South Africa enjoy very warm relations, and Vladimir Putin and Jacob Zuma personally have a very warm relation indeed. And of course, relations between South Africa and Russia dates back to the Soviet times, when the USSR was providing military training and arms to the African National Congress.
Clever listener, you're listening to The Commute, and I'm Jessica Van Onselen. Today we're carrying on our interview with Professor Irina Filatova, an expert on South African-Russian relations and co-author of the book The Hidden Thread, Russia and South Africa in the Soviet Era. In part one of our interview with Irina, which is in episode one if you want to find it, we discussed the ANC's history of support from the USSR under apartheid and how many of the Soviet ideas from the 1960s and 70s still feature heavily in the ANC's thinking, even today in 2018. The focus of part two of the interview today is one of my favorite politicians, Vladimir Putin. Researching Putin yields an array of images that, once you've viewed them on YouTube, cannot be unseen. In case you didn't already know, Putin puts a lot of emphasis on being manly. There's Putin doing butterfly in a freezing Siberian river. There's Putin putting out wildfires while flying a plane. There he is, riding a horse shirtless. There's Putin handling Siberian tigers. And there's his 2008 video called Let's Learn Judo with Vladimir Putin. I shit you not. When Putin is not meddling in foreign elections or ordering nerve gas attacks on his enemies, we know he's missing his bestie Jacob Zuma, who is, sadly, no longer president. I asked Irina to tell me a little bit more about Russia under Putin and how South Africa fits into Russia's worldview.
In South Africa today, we have this. We still have a leadership that's very much thinking and referring to that training in the USSR. But if I pivot over and I look at Russia, it seems to me that Russia today is starting to demonstrate an interest in regaining, and I put it in quotation marks, the glory days of the Soviet Empire. And at the heart of a lot of that is President Vladimir Putin, and he's all over the news for Trump and America and all that sort of stuff. But could you just tell us a little bit about who Vladimir Putin is? Where did he come from? Who is he as a president?
It is a well-known fact that Putin was a KGB officer in Germany, in East Germany, that he speaks very good German, and he's been there for a long time. And with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the party, he buried his party card and started a new life. And he started it in St. Petersburg, that's his city where he was born, and spent his childhood. He started to work for the then mayor of St. Petersburg. That was the era of just after the collapse of the USSR. Anatoly Sobchak was one of those new elected mayors, a very bright, interesting, and so on person. But Putin worked for him. And according to some claims, it's already at that time when the corruption started. But I won't go into that. He has been, he's turned out to be a very talented politician. He was at some stage head of the KGB, or rather FSB, as it is called now. Then he was selected by Yeltsin, the first president of independent Russia. Yeltsin has gone through several prime ministers. The reasons for this are not quite clear, but he stopped on Putin, who was at that time not a very well-known person, and certainly not loved by the media or the population. His ratings were very low, and nevertheless, Yeltsin chose him as his successor and basically just appointed him. He resigned and appointed him as the next president. Of course, there was election after that, and of course, Putin won, but not with the ratings that he has now. So
but Yeltsin must have seen some sort of talents in him.
He either seen some talents in him, or you see, Yeltsin was accused of corruption again, also, so he may have had a deal with Putin about non-prosecution, or I don't know. So that is we don't know anything about it. But there must have been some reason, or he saw that maybe Putin is a strong leader potentially. I don't know what he found in him. But he had the choice among people who were in politics and around him for much longer, and all of them were sort of rejected. So that is Putin. He is he has a very good team of advisors, or he is a talented politician indeed. If you see how he deals with Trump, my God, it's he can twist Trump around his finger, I think.
Well, that is the question, Irina, and I want to... That's a separate podcast.
I'm not going into
the United States admire the president of Russia quite so much?
Well, he's a strong guy, but there may be other reasons. I think Trump admires power, and Trump admires people who are strong leaders in their own right. So,
at the time of recording, listeners, Trump has just announced that he's going to overrule Congress's instruction to impose sanctions on Russia. He's personally going to veto that and decline to put sanctions on Russia, which has got us all scratching our heads. Okay, but that's a separate podcast, Irina. We can talk about that. But just to come back to Putin, so what is his vision for Russia, would you say? And also, how does South Africa fit into that, or Africa fit into that vision?
You have mentioned empire. I don't think that Putin thinks in these terms of empire, but he does think about glory days. It's absolutely correct. For him, Russia is a world of its own. It is not exactly Europe. It's certainly not America. It has got its own values and its own religion. Putin has become very religious.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
No, he has. And that is a very important part of his behavior now, of his political behavior. You know perhaps that Russian Christianity is different from the Western Christianity, and there has been centuries and centuries from the beginning of Christianity, there has been this hostility between the two churches. And so this opposition to the West has not always been like that, because when Putin came to power, he tried to get closer to the West. At some stage, he even said that Russia would join NATO or European Union or something like that. Then it was all gone.
What era was this when he came into power, when there was this rapprochement with the West?
Wasn't really rapprochement, because Russia had, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the first 10 years of the existence of independent Russia, there were much closer relations with the West. But of course, at that time, Russia was a very, very economically weak state. Mm-hmm. Putin came to power 1st January 2000. What that meant was that, first of all, it was just at that stage when Russian economy started to go up. So he inherited good relations with the West, or relatively good relations with the West. But also what he inherited at that time was the Russian public, which was already annoyed by the West's treatment of Russia, because Russia was humiliated, you see. At that time, the country was not treated seriously at all, neither in the military sense, nor in the economic sense, nor in political sense. It just lost its weight and it was treated as a defeated enemy, which was a huge mistake on the part of the West. It was a huge mistake. They should have known better. But anyway, under him, not because of him, but perhaps with his encouragement, the economy started to get better. He was incredibly lucky with oil prices. That has been what Russian economy was based on. That is what was going on. You may remember that it started with about $30 per barrel, and it just went over 100, and it was all in
and
the
people
first...
were talking about 200. That's yeah. how
yeah.
positive
it was. So it was. It seemed that it's just an eternal turn up, and Russia, of course, benefited enormously, and Putin's elite benefited, and that's when the corruption flourished. But this is what Putin's ideology is: strong Russia, militarily, economically. Whatever is going on inside, it doesn't really matter, but it has to be strong Russia.
And pushing back against that humiliation.
Pushing back against that humiliation. Now, about the empire, Putin wants, and many Russians perceive today, that all these former Soviet republics, which are independent countries now, they are part of the Soviet world or Eurasia, that culturally, economically, and in every possible way, they belong to us. You stay there with your world, we don't go there, but leave us with our world, which includes, of course, Kazakhstan, Georgia, Armenia, whatever, and of course in Europe it does include first of all Ukraine,
yeah,
but also Belarus and the Baltic states and so on, because the Russian minorities are very strong there. And of course Russian influence is now rather strong in Hungary and Czech Republic and Poland. So that is in Poland not so much, but in those two. But that is the situation. So he's trying to recreate this Eurasian world around the European-Asian mentality. And Russia is, of course, the center of it. Ukraine is crucially important in that if you don't have Ukraine, not necessarily as part of your state, but as part of your sphere of influence, then you don't have Eurasia.
Which explains why the Russians invaded
yeah.
Ukraine.
Hello, good morning to you. It is Saturday, the 1st of March, 2014. I'm Anna Koyman. A Fox News alert. Crisis in Ukraine. Russian troops roar into the country, blocking roads and airports. And this morning, new reports that they are seizing control of missile bases. The latest on the tense situation straight ahead.
I'm always interested by strong leaders, strong men, and I'm thinking here of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe or Paul Kagame in Rwanda. While they're clearly authoritarian, they are unwilling to abandon the accoutrements of democracy. So they keep up having elections, they still have a press, they sometimes even have opposition parties. But if they have elections, they're going to win overwhelmingly, which always makes me wonder about their relationship with democracy. What is Putin's attitude or what is your sense of how he perceives the democratic project, democracy?
Well, it depends what you call democracy and what you call democratic project, because there are many ways as managed democracy, there is independent democracy and so on and so forth. So Putin absolutely is keeping the trinkets of democracy, such as elections. He has allowed so far, even a couple of independent newspapers. There is one very weak and more or less disappearing independent cable TV channel. But the propaganda machine and the use of the internet and all that, it's so strong now that he actually can allow absolutely free and fair elections. He will be re-elected, and his party, despite the fact that it's not very popular, it would still be re-elected.
But he is enormously popular.
He is enormously popular. And you see how Russian mentality works. In 2012, he said that he would be coming. He was prime minister. See, he's keeping the trinkets of democracy because he knew that after two terms, according to the constitution, he can't be a president again. So he put Medvedev in his place and became prime minister. And then after Medvedev's one term, he is returning as president. So that was what outraged particularly the politically conscious public in big cities, and particularly in Moscow. There were huge anti-Putin demonstrations, huge. He's won the elections, that's okay. He would have in any case, but then his ratings were right down at that time. I wouldn't say down, but they were much lower than they had been before then. So then comes 2014 and the Crimea, and Putin's ratings went right up.
So he is just hugely popular.
He is very popular, yes.
And so this is Putin rebuilding a strong Russia. We know that he's really sort of taking on the European Union, and he's giving Trump a run for his money. Well, Trump seems to love him anyway. But where does Africa fit into this?
There are several reasons for Russia's interest in Africa. First of all, its business interest. Of course, the Russians like and would like to have more deals with African countries, not just South Africa. More deals, more beneficial deals, which they can get. They are selling arms to many African countries, and they are selling technology. It was not only the nuclear deal. They also built a satellite for the South Africans. So there
we
is.
We launched a shared satellite a few years ago.
So that was that is a business side of things, and of course the nuclear deal, if it happened, it would have benefited the Russians tremendously. It would have killed the South African economy, but, you know, these things happen.
Well, we might still have it to look forward to, but hopefully.
Yeah, that is true. So this is one side of things. But the other side of things is that there is the common mentality. They are both countries which are part of BRICS. And BRICS it may be perceived differently by different participants, but certainly Russians and South Africans are united in their idea of changing the world balance away from the West. I can't say it's anti-Western union or anti-Western organization, because gosh, India and China, first of all, they have very close ties with the West, and they wouldn't want the Western economies to collapse. But the Russians and the South Africans do have that common idea that the West is the enemy. Whether it's capitalist or socialist or whatever, but the West is the enemy. South Africans speak about it more openly than the Russians, but that element is also there.
A fifth of the world's economy, almost a half of Earth's population, the BRICS nations are set to counter the Western domination and they're banking on a new global order. Can the new BRICS bank balance the Western hold on international finance? Will the member states be able to cement their bloc with closer ties? And how will their rising strength reshape the world in years to come?
The Russians need allies. They have been ostracized by the West, and they don't like it, so they need allies. And South Africa is again emerging as one of its trusted allies.
You know, we know that President Putin came to South Africa on a state visit in 2006, a big state visit. I think you say he had 350 people with him. You know, Mbeki was still in power. And we know that the Russian oligarch has been quite active in South Africa, lots of business deals, Viktor Vekselberg and some of his mining interests. And now we know we've spoken about the shared history. I guess what I'm actually surprised about is I'm wondering why there haven't been even more trade relations with Russia, given the shared history and sort of mutual respect and love affair between Russian leadership and the South African leadership.
Look, there were more meetings and more visits. Putin visited South Africa again in 2013, and Zuma visited Russia many times. These contacts, the official contacts, are now wonderful and brilliant, and they do understand one another. That's political level. The economic level is much more difficult because trade relations, yes, South Africa does supply Russia with fruit. It has invested, the Mondly Papers have invested in Russia, and
it's now the biggest
beer
and
so
Russia.
On. The Russian goods is much more difficult. What can Russia supply? It can supply technology, and it has been for some things. But it's very far. They are very far from one another. Russian produce, either agricultural produce or anything like that, can't export it to here. The car market, car production, the Russian-made cars are bad quality, and they have always been. So forget about that. Russia can supply technologies, and I think that in this sphere it is developing. It depends on South Africa, actually, how much of it it can and want to absorb. Of course, South Africa can supply Russia with mining technologies, and I don't know whether anything is done in that respect or not. But trade relations are not that easy. They are two countries very far apart, and it's difficult to find the exact goods that can be exchanged, exported, imported, and so on. Some of them have been found, as we've just discussed, but not many. So trade is one thing. Investment is a different thing. It's again, you have to find a sphere which is not occupied by other countries, and it's not easy. That is why the corrupt element comes into being. What can I say? It's not as easy as it looks, despite the ideology, despite common history.
So, in fact, trying to find an area of mutual benefit and mutual influence is perhaps more tricky than with somewhere like China. Interesting. Irina, I have a last question which I ask all of my guests, which is, could you recommend a book or some books that if our listeners want to learn a little bit more about South Africa and Russia might be interesting for them to pick up?
Look, there are many books about Russia, so I won't even go into that. But first of all, my book is not about Russia, it's about the history of relations between Russia and South Africa. And If somebody is interested in this topic, it gives a very interesting outline of Russian assistance to the Boers during the Anglo-Boer War. It gives the outline of relations during the Comintern era, 1920s, 1930s, and South African communist students coming to study in the Soviet Union and what they found. The relations during the war, many people have forgotten that there were diplomatic relations at that time and that they were very successful. The two countries were quite close for a long time. There was a lot of admiration for the Soviet Union in South Africa. It was very popular. And then, of course, the ANC and its armed struggle and the Soviet assistance to the armed struggle and to the ANC. And then, of course, the collapse of that. That is why and how it all happened and why the collapse of the Soviet Union and the change of the policy of the Soviet Union was important for South Africa. And the relations between NIS and the KGB, that is also a very interesting part of it for me. So yes, please, the book is called The Hidden Thread, Russia and South Africa in the Soviet Era. There are very few books that cover such a broad range of issues, but there is a book which I mentioned already, Vladimir Shubin, who was an official of the Central Committee who was dealing with the ANC and the Communist Party, published the book ANC, A View from Moscow. There were two editions of the book. The first edition was in 1999. And it's a book which covers these relations in great detail. And many people would find lots and lots of useful information in it. On the other hand, I can say that Shubin, being a loyal and faithful communist and loyal to the South African Communist Party, not only to the Soviet one, he presents the official view of the South African Communist Party on events and even on facts. Because although he's, of course, not Reverend Pike, but he, for example, assured the reader that Mandela has never been a communist. And
but we know that's not true now.
We now know that it is not true. So it is a very interesting book, but take into consideration that it has these deficiencies.
You're going to get the party line, capital P, capital
absolutely.
L. Listeners, I will put the descriptions and titles and authors of these books in the show notes. So if you haven't got them here, don't worry. You'll be able to look in the show notes and I will write the name and details of these books. And that just leaves me to say, Professor Filatova, thank you so much. It has
thank
been
you,
totally
Jessica.
Fascinating. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Commute. I'm Jessica Van Onselen. Do you understand blockchain technology? Do you understand Bitcoin? Or are you just faking it so that you don't sound stupid at dinner parties? If so, we have a fantastic explainer in episode 3, The Idea of Bitcoin. We have a South African-Swedish expert who will tell you everything you need to know about cryptocurrencies in super simple terms. Visit us at www.thecommute.co.za for more episodes. You can find us on social media, even though it totally kills me, or you can email me at thecommutesay@gmail.com.